Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We have reached episode 3 in our series with Leia Ippi about the history of freedom. And today I'm talking to Leia about Machiavelli and the idea of political freedom. What does it mean to live in a free state? What does it mean to live free from domination? And what are the institutions that can rescue human beings from being at the mercy of others? Past, Present, Future is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books, and the LRB has got a new podcast out about the sinking of the General Belgrano, the bloodiest and most controversial action of the Falklands War. It tells the story of the diary written on board the submarine that fired the torpedoes, and it uncovers what really happened. Hosted by Andrew O'Hagan, you can get the podcast now. Just go to lrb.me/Belgrano or wherever you get your podcasts. Leia, when we were talking about Greek and Roman ideas of freedom, we actually didn't discuss what I suspect most Greeks and Romans would have said was the basic definition of freedom, or the basic definition of unfreedom, which is your state is taken over by another state. You're captured, you're conquered, you're sold into slavery. I mean, the most basic definition of unfreedom of all. The test of whether there's any possibility of leading a free life is you have to live somewhere which is not controlled, conquered by another power. So the idea of a free state is absolutely key. And we were talking about it in terms of individuals and their search for the truth and so on. But it's irrelevant if you're sold into slavery, if the men are killed, the women and children are enslaved. So the idea of a free state was always key. And then that raised the question of, if you are a free state in that sense, what has to go on inside the state for the conditions of freedom to hold internally? So we're going to discuss that today, not in the Greek and Roman literal context, but let's jump forward 1500 years. Machiavelli, beginning of the 16th century, writing about Rome primarily. Machiavelli, who's best known now as the author of The Prince, which is a book about if you're the sole ruler of a state, how to stay in power. And it is, among other things, a satire of Christianity, of Christian love. Better to be feared than to be loved, so much for Christian love. But Machiavelli isn't just a Machiavellian. He's also passionate defender of a certain kind of idea of freedom, which is usually called republican freedom. And that's what we're going to try and unpick here. So there are lots of different puzzles about that version of freedom. You're a free state. You live in a free state. You're not conquered. You're not enslaved. Your borders, your walls are controlled by you, so you can make sure that the people who want to kill you don't get in. Then how do you organize yourself internally? And one of Machiavelli's arguments, drawing on the history of Rome, is that you need two qualities in a free people of a free state. One is they have to be virtuous, an old-fashioned classical idea. They have to be good citizens. They have to be patriotic. They have to want to defend this state. It won't defend itself. But the other thing, which is perhaps more surprising, is they have to be argumentative, difficult, querulous, suspicious. You know, if you live in a state and the citizens take on trust what they're being told by the people with the power, the offices, the ability to make the rules, those people will become corrupt. You've got to keep challenging them, push back. Don't believe what you're told. And I mean, maybe it's a version of the Socrates puzzle we talked about last time. How are you a good democrat without destroying democracy? So how are you a good citizen in this version of freedom without being so damn argumentative and suspicious that in the end you actually undermine people's trust in the institutions? That, it seems to me, is one of the basic puzzles here.
Yeah, although I would maybe go just a little bit back, because I think I have a slightly different diagnosis of how and where this Machiavellian problem arises, which is, I think you're right that Machiavelli praises virtue and civic virtue and participation, and to him the freedom of the city is very important. But I don't think that conflict is a virtue for him. It's just a fact of life. And to some extent, the question for him arises because there are no virtues that can help you manage conflicts other than the ones that will emerge from within the city themselves, from within this conflict. And so it's a question of how you balance the different parties to a conflict in the city such that from their antagonism, from their relationship, something stable might emerge. And to some extent, I think it's really important that in a way, Machiavelli, he's writing in a moment of crisis of Christianity and of Christian values. And as you say, in The Prince, he kind of takes over Christianity head on. But in the discourses on Livy, there is also a sense in which these Christian institutions aren't there to guarantee the stability and the freedom of the city anymore. And this is a world, you know, a little bit like ours in a way, a world where people don't really believe in anything, and hypocrisy and corruption. And so how do we then, out of these vices of people, how can we create something good? And I think this is where, in a way, the primacy of politics becomes the crucial element in Machiavelli's writing. And this is where it's not that there is no morality. It's not that there are no notions of the good. It's not that there is no virtue, because clearly freedom is very important. But none of them is enough, given how the dynamics of the city unfold and given the kinds of conflicts. And I think he was also very insightful in understanding that there is also a kind of collective nature of interest that is not just the interest of individuals, but there are parts of the city that have different kinds of interests. And the question is, how can you design institutions that channel these interests in such a way that none of them prevail and dominates over the others?
So part of that is pushback. It's not a virtue. I agree. I don't think he's saying that being suspicious is a virtue, unless that's part of the satire as well. But absolutely, it is key to this that the different parts of the city have the ability to push back against each other. So if one part dominates the other, the rich, the poor, the rich, it could be either way around, the thing is going to break down and it will become corrupt. If you have power that doesn't meet resistance, and we know this is true then, it's true now, like, power will find a way to become corrupt unless something pushes back against it. And it's a literal pushback. So it also includes things like veto powers. So within the institutional arrangements of this kind of city, the ability to say no, it doesn't mean, if you say no, it doesn't make you a virtuous citizen. You're a virtuous citizen if you're willing to die for the city. But the ability to say no is one of the keys to internal freedom. But it is negative. I mean, that's part of the challenge of this, that virtue, civic virtue, is not on the whole a negative value in that sense. But an institutional setup which is designed around the ability of some citizens or groups of citizens, parties within the state, to say no to other groups is the key to this thing surviving.
That's right. And in a way, order is created out of the balancing of these different parties in conflict with each other without ever attempting to suppress the conflict, because he doesn't think that you can ever really suppress the conflict. That's part of what it means to be rich in a city and to be poor in a city. Although, interestingly, he doesn't think, and I think it's very important, he doesn't think that the rich and the poor dominate in the same way. He says the rich want to dominate, the poor don't want to be dominated. And the overarching value in a city is freedom as non-domination, as that which emerges from this kind of dynamic between these different social groups, let's say.
So better to be ruled by the poor?
Well, he says poor don't have power, and what they don't want is they don't want to be ruled by the rich. What Machiavelli tries to do is to think about what kind of institutions can safeguard the poor from the domination of the rich in a way that enables them to have, for example, veto powers, or to have institutions that prevent the rich from accessing them. He gives the example of the tribunate, for example, in ancient Rome, when he cites these old institutions to try and give models of how one might think about city and how one might think of representation, if we want to call it this kind of modern word, representation in a city, in such a way that it's group differentiated representation, which is not something that we have anymore, because now we have this idea of general representation. We have parties, and in some ways they are parts, but they're not parts in the way in which they were in the Machiavellian world, because in the Machiavellian world, the parties were parts with different interests, whereas in our societies, the idea is that parties have a notion of the common good that they all serve, and they have these common values, and so it's something slightly different.
They just disagree about what the common good is.
That's right, exactly. I'm more on Machiavelli's side on this because I think this is more our ideal of the parties. In practice, contemporary parties, I think, are much like the parts in Machiavelli's City, where they really have different interests, not just different values, but they also are driven by completely antagonistic motives. And I also agree with Machiavelli that the rich, they want to dominate, and the poor, they just want to be protected from domination somehow. And, you know, this dynamic of the few and the many, the rich happen to be the few and the poor happen to be the many. And this is also important in a way that there's a small group of people that concentrates power. But yeah, I think it's interesting that as part of his response to how do you address the conflict in the city, how do you address the crisis, he thinks about the kinds of institutions that empowers different groups in different ways. And that's something that we don't really have. We don't have alternative courts for the poor or things like that, the kind of things that Machiavelli would have supported.
There is a modern state which was founded on some of these principles. It's the United States of America. So it has many of these republican institutions, separation of powers and veto powers, different parts of the state checking each other. Like you say, the weird thing about it is it's morphed into this more modern, and Machiavelli was only just modern, he maybe wasn't even modern, modern version of it, which is they're competing to speak for the people as a whole. And there's an idea that there is something called the American people and the different parties speak for the people as a whole. And yet, as you say, probably that's not true, that the different parts of the state are speaking for particular interests. And so within that setup, you get actually a thing which maybe doesn't work at all. So sometimes contemporary America is called a, I don't know how to say this word, vetocracy or vetoocracy, but in which, though it's set up to promote virtue, talk about that, but also to allow people to resist being dominated within the state, what it actually allows is special interest groups to block any kind of collective action at all. And they use the weapons of the vetoes that exist to protect the disadvantaged. If you have money, if you have power, a vetocracy works really well for you. And so this is one of the dangers of that version of Republican politics, which is it can be captured by the groups that it was designed to constrain.
But I think it's only captured when it doesn't recognize that this is what it does in a way. So weirdly, in the Machiavellian case, it's less likely to be captured because all groups are empowered equally and institutions are designed in such a way that the rich just don't have access. If the poor have these institutions where they have veto powers, the problem, I think, is that what we think as tracking this Machiavellian model through the separation of powers is simply functional differentiation of the offices of the state. And so you have the judiciary, you have the courts, they have their job, you have the government, you have the legislative, you have the parliaments do another thing. And so then you have this kind of functional differentiation. But when you actually have what Machiavelli would call group interests or class interests, or I mean, he calls it the umori, the humors of the city, which have these different features and in the end are the ones that produces different and interests and so on. What you have in contemporary democracies, in American democracies, rich are empowered in that way through lobbying, for example, campaign finance. So they have the kinds of institutions that enable them to exercise much more influence. But the poor don't have any of those kinds of institutions. They really are left to their own devices in this abstract general idea of representation with the notion that party politics will just track their voices. And it doesn't. It tracks them in a very asymmetrical way. So I think this is what's really interesting. Because in a way we have an ideal of the citizen as abstract and universal representation, because we think we have moved beyond the corporate representation of the medieval world, we think we don't need those institutions anymore. And what Machiavelli does is really, and if you read him as a contemporary with some, you know, perhaps some degree of simplification and loss of nuance and context and so on, but to the extent that you access his text as though he was a contemporary, what he says is actually, look, it's in the nature of the city that there are these different interests, that there are these different classes, that they fight each other and there is class conflict. And so what are you going to do about it? And it's a very sobering account of the political when you see it with in light of how we think of the political right now. But I think one that is actually weirdly closer to our reality than the ideal of citizenship that we have.
in America, you have the Senate, which nominally would have been the representative body for the rich in a way, and then the House of Representatives, which represents ordinary people in a different way. Both are now representative assemblies of the rich because it takes a hell of a lot of money to get into them, maybe a bit less to get into the House of Representatives. And the way they're differentiated is just mechanically by process. So Senate, you have a six-year term. So that allows you to take, in theory, not in practice, a longer view to be a bit more above the fray. And in the House of Representatives, it's a very quote-unquote democratic institution because it's every 2 years. But you need money all the way through. In fact, every 2 years, you're basically campaigning for re-election from the beginning. So how would you redo it? I mean, if you wanted to get back to there being a representative assembly, which is for the people who don't have access to the money, you can't do it under modern conditions just by stipulating rules that make them more accountable simply in terms of the time that they serve in office. You could exclude money in particular ways that people are always talking about campaign finance reform. But what would you do institutionally? Would you just call it the House of the Poor?
There have been some, so I'm not being particularly original here, but there are efforts to rethink Machiavellian democracy for our times. And some of them take the form of exactly creating institutions from which the wealthy are excluded. So exactly something like a tribunate of the poor in ancient Rome that would also function by wealth differentiation in contemporary societies, and that would just give veto powers, or would give trial powers, to certain underrepresented groups in society. There are other mechanisms. I think there's things that you can do with also with party democracy, actually. So just campaign finance is one of them. Mechanisms of recall of representatives are also a way in which you could limit how much power one can accumulate in office. If an office holder isn't allowed to, an MP isn't allowed to hold their office for longer than a certain amount of time, or if they can be recalled from below by their constituents, there is only so much effect that lobbying will have on them, because people will know that these MPs are not going to be in power forever. And so there is a sense in which none of these effects become ingrained, and there is a fluidity and there's more dynamism in society. And there's something called the imperative mandate, which is an old idea that came out around the French Revolution, was proposed by particular revolutionary groups. It also had to do with this idea of the power remaining with the constituents, and whereby the MP is just a voice of the constituents, but actually it needs to track their interests and their principles through and through, rather than just being elected by them and then going on and doing their own thing. So there are ways in which I think we can tighten up the connection between representatives and the represented in such a way that the represented have more power. And these are all some sort of institutional design ideas that might be inspired by something like the Machiavellian model.
One of the fears of that kind of politics in a realistic account of the modern world is that there are also the institutions, I'm not going to call them of the deep state, but there are the deep institutions of the state, which have a much more permanent character, the institutions of the bureaucracy, the institutions of government. And if you empower constituents, and it's essentially a negative power, it's a recall power, it's not a power to enact legislation, it's a power to say we're pissed off and we've had enough. Actually, though the idea is to hold those institutions to account, it becomes harder and harder. There's churn in one part of the political system, and then there's an underlying continuity in other places too. And part of this is about surveillance, to use a modern word. It's about keeping an eye on the people who have the real power. And the assumption, I think, of the American system is that power needs to match power. So if you have one group where there's a lot of churn and there's a lot of accountability and there's discord and querulousness and pissed off constituents saying we've had enough, and then you have the educated, entrenched political elite in their institutions, say in the treasury or wherever the real power lies in a state, it can be harder to hold them to account.
Yeah, and I also don't think any of these reforms can actually work by themselves. So they have to be something that goes alongside other kinds of reforms. And for a start, I mean, I think you need a highly educated citizenry to be able to even have these mechanisms of recall, because people can recall for the wrong reasons. And so they need to be informed and they need to be political. And so I think it is a radical democratic measure in that it takes really seriously this idea of representation and continuing to be represented, not just on election day, which is what we think we're doing. You know, we go, we vote for a party, we select an MP, and then the MP goes and does their own thing. And we are completely detached from then the workings of parliament and so on. I think this is a much more demanding model in that that the citizens are constantly involved. But on the other hand, there has to be a real vehicles through which the citizens are educated and interested in politics. And there also has to be a chance for them to really see that it makes a difference that they are constantly involved. So it's not just about turning up and voting, because also who suggests, who proposes the agenda, who draws up the lines of conversation, what kind of issues we're deciding on, and so on. These are all likely to be captured by the rich. So just because we're voting, and just because we're voting all the time, or just because we have this means of recall and others proposals like that, I don't think any of that is going to be enough. This is why I think it has to go alongside reform of a more economic nature. And this is also something that the ancients knew. I mean, we talked about Plato last time. Plato thought that you couldn't hold in the laws, not in the Republic, but in the laws, he thinks you can't have property more than a certain amount, because otherwise it has corruptive effects on politics. Likewise, Machiavelli thinks that how we think about property and property distribution in the Republic is also really important. So none of these authors is under any illusion that just making these changes to institutional design without affecting the distribution of property at all is likely to change the game. It's they are reforms that keep the system accountable, but that need to go alongside something like socioeconomic reform.
And then it becomes a bit of a chicken and egg problem, because what are the institutions that are going to affect reforms that allow institutions like the ones that you've described to work? Or maybe you're talking about a revolution.
So it's really interesting. And this is where the role of, in pre-modern politics, the role of the founder is important, right? There is always in these books, obviously Machiavelli discussed the prince and, you know, the role of the prince in leading and maintaining power. And but also in the history of...
But also in the history of Rome, Rome has to be founded before it can be a republic.
Exactly. In discourses on Livy as well, you have this idea of the founder. I mean, Rousseau, the whole, I think, democratic tradition is replete with this trope of the founder, because there needs to be a moment where things go from being one way to being another way. And usually in, I would say, pre-democratic, pre-modern politics, it's an individual, it's a character. I'm really interested in sort of interpretations of Machiavelli, like Gramsci, for example, where he says, well, what is the prince now? And he says, well, it's the party. And there is a, something like a modern prince, that there has to be an institution that brings together individuals in a certain way and has this collective will formation process that then enables that institution to lead change. But I think none of these authors denies, and I think it's hard to deny, that there is often a moment of arbitrariness and decision making that isn't completely accountable by democratic standards, that there is a rupture at some point, and the rupture can't be fully justified. It's a rupture. It's a revolution, or it doesn't have to be a revolution, but it is a moment of, it can be a crisis, it can be war, it can be something kind of external shock to the system that triggers fundamental change. Otherwise, from the inside, it's very difficult.
As you said, one of the ways that this is sometimes characterized is it's a theory of non-domination. So it's sometimes called a neo-Roman theory, because Machiavelli is essentially writing about the Roman Republic, neo-republican, non-domination. And political theorists call this a third concept of liberty. So I just want to get your take on these three concepts, because it's a very familiar way in academic circles, but you know, it has more reach than that of talking about freedom. I'll just try and very quickly summarize them, and then I want to get your sense of it, because as you've described it, you know, I keep using this word, it's pretty demanding. And I want to just get a feeling from you whether you think this really is a distinctive conception of freedom. So the original two concepts, which are associated with the philosopher Isaiah Berlin, negative freedom and positive freedom, or negative liberty and positive liberty. Negative is the familiar idea that you are free when you are not being coerced or interfered with or constrained, literally when you're not in chains. It is the absence of something, the absence of interference or constraint. Positive liberty, as the name suggests, is the presence of something. You have to have a capacity and ability to do something, and it may include something as full as self-mastery in some of the ways that we were talking about. The reason this Machiavellian version is thought to be a third concept is it doesn't quite fit either of those two. So it's not simply you are free when no one is telling you what to do, because you might have very limited possibilities for, among other things, objecting to the way that the city that you live in is being run. But it doesn't require you to be free in the positive sense, in that you say this thing has to be present. It's non-domination, because the key test is not, are you being told what to do? Are you at this moment being forced to turn left rather than right. But does someone have the capacity, which they may not have used, but at least in potential, to tell you to do that? And if they do, even if they're not telling you to do that, you are in their shadow. So part of this is, again, an argument about slavery and the thing that I talked about last time, the good master and the bad master, the slave who says, I'm okay because the person who's enslaved me is a lovely guy. On this account, that's not freedom because you are still potentially at the mercy of that person, even if they're allowing you to lead your life. So this is about a version of freedom where you have to have the capacity to say no to the person who might dominate you, but you don't have to be someone who has self-mastery. Is it distinct from those other two?
I think it is distinct, and I think it is attractive as well, but very demanding, as you say. I think it's distinct because it's not agent-centered in a way. Both of these, both the negative and the positive conception, are about the agent and either what is being done to the agent or what must be given to the agent for them to flourish and so on. And I think this non-domination conception of freedom, or, you know, there is other ways of tracking it. It doesn't have to be just about non-domination. To me, what makes it distinctive is that it's relational. It's about intersubjective dimension of how human behavior, of how we relate to each other, of what we expect others to do for us and us to do for them. And in that sense, I think it is slightly different because it takes you to a different realm. I find it in other authors as well. And I think Kant has something similar when he talks about freedom as a set of moral responsibilities and moral relations in a way. And it's a kind of freedom that, as philosophers say, it's robust across counterfactuals, meaning it has to be true that you are not dominated, even if you are not actually dominated. If you could potentially be dominated, then you are still unfree in a way. And it's, some people would say, well, why does it matter what's counterfactual the case? All I care is if I'm free or not free. But in some ways it does matter, because if you start thinking about relations and how human relations develop and how history unfolds and what could happen politically, just because you happen to have a nice master doesn't mean that when there is another master or when there is a crisis or something else happens, then you will go back to experiencing unfreedom in this way in which you think you care only if you care about negative freedom. So I find it really interesting. The challenge is how you think about the counterfactuals and what does it mean for freedom to be guaranteed across these counterfactuals? So what does it mean to think about the other likely scenarios where you could be dominated, where you're actually guaranteed from not being dominated if you live in this world free from domination? And that's where it becomes more open to the future in a way.
Yeah, because I think the assumption here is that the most obvious way in which a human being is cowed is if they think there's an immediate threat to them. But you are also cowed by the possibility of a hypothetical threat, and it makes it harder to have an open view of the future. It is a defensive position that you are thinking about, I really like the way my life is going now, so I better be careful that I don't piss off or alienate the people who might have power over me in future, which is a different way of thinking about the future than that. There's a robustness to the security that I feel now, which allows me to imagine a range of different futures. So it's partly about leaving the future open, which is not true even if you're leading a good life. And maybe you can be trapped in that good life as well. You know, you can be unfree because you're so determined to hang on to what you've got, and that means not angering the people who could take it away from you, that you don't think about what it would be to live in a world in which you don't have that fear.
Well, exactly. And which is why I think then opening up to the counterfactuals makes the whole questions of ideology and manipulation much more vivid, because you ask yourself, what would I be like if I wasn't? I mean, I now think these days a lot about algorithms and being dominated or shaped or manipulated by algorithms. What would it be like if I were to take my decisions free from what I'm being driven to click one way or another? And it's only if you have the counterfactual in mind, if you have the hypothetical alternative world in which you could be living in mind, that you are then able to see, well, there is a dimension in which my life is actually being conditioned by other forces outside my control, which is what this whole ideal of non-domination is about. And I think that's important, and it plays an important critical function in someone's life or in the way they assess their politics, the way they assess their society, that they constantly ask themselves, well, what would an alternative world in which these things didn't happen? Now, some people would say, oh, well, that's, you know, it's irrelevant, it's utopian, it's a waste of time and so on. But our capacity to question and to hold officials to account, to question politicians, to question the societies in which we live, all depends on us holding on to that counterfactual somehow.
It's also true that this version of freedom, freedom as non-domination, it's political all the way through, and the Machiavellian version of it is primarily about political institutions, but then it can be applied outside of what we think of conventionally as politics. So, for instance, where are people most likely to be dominated? At work is one place, not just by algorithms, but by bosses. So you have, you know, nice master, not nice master. I'm not trying to trivialize slavery here, but there are many working conditions in which nice boss, not nice boss, feels like the most important thing. And if you have a nice boss or a boss who's treating you well, you are cowed by that. You're not free, even though you're a lot better off than the people who have got an abusive boss. And then the question is, does it require institutional remedy? So do you need in the workplace, it's a very old-fashioned term, I don't know if there are workplaces, but you know what I mean. I mean, there are people physically still show up, but in the institutions of a corporation or whatever it is, do you need actually something similar to what you were talking about here, some place where the workers are represented completely free from the potential of domination by the bosses, or in the family. The family is another classic version of this. Women, children, maybe even sometimes men, can be dominated in family setup. So one version of a sort of neo-republican family structure that I've read is that this sounds like a very conservative argument. It's actually a radical argument. You need two parents, not one. You don't want an absent father, not because the family is a nice traditional institution, but if you're a child, you need to be able to appeal to one parent against the other parent. And if you only have one parent, you're more likely to be dominated than if you have two. And that's about the power of the child. It's not about a conservative ideal of the family, but it's institutional. We don't tend to think about the family as a way of life that requires institutional reform?
Well, I think you need multiple parents, actually, not just two parents. So I think in terms of if you start thinking about reforming the family and non-domination and so on, there is a whole range of counterfactual possibilities or ways of reimagining the family that go from, yes, starting with the kind of two parents, bourgeois families that we're familiar with, to all the way to the Platonic model and of multiple parents and multiple children and all of the communal child rearing practices that Plato discusses in the Republic, which I think are in some ways all driven by this concern for freedom as non-domination. And we don't think about them because we're not used to thinking about counterfactuals and because there are some things that are so ingrained in us that it's really hard to imagine what would it be like for your children to be actually raised by someone else. I mean, it's somehow beyond our capacities to even imagine.
Well, our children are all in part raised by someone else. To be a child is to be subject to multiple sources of authority. We do send them to school.
But how you make all the sources of authority accountable to the child and ensure that they don't exercise arbitrary power. And it becomes really hard and really... So I think the family is really interesting, but also very demanding and very hard because there's so much that is ingrained in us that stops us from thinking. But to go back to the workplace, I think something like traditional social democracy was actually premised institutionally on this idea of empowering workers to bargain with employers in such a way that employers wouldn't hold arbitrary power on them, and the dismantling of traditional social democracy, which was based on the recognition that there is class antagonism, there is class conflict, much like the Machiavellian recognition. Our societies are shaped by these conflicts. Capitalism is driven by this kind of conflict. And what can you do once you've given up more or less, as social democrats did at some point in the turn of the century, from the notion of revolution and socialism? They then hold on to the idea that what you need to do is to recognize which are the agents that you need to empower. And the working classes were the agents that needed to be empowered. And so trade union power was the institutional reflection of that notion of non-domination that I think shaped a lot of these institutional design experiences in the 20th century, which we have now more or less abandoned. And we have gone back to a model of where the rich just rule and just exercise power and where the workers have very little by way of countering that.
But is that partly about the changing nature of work as well? So I said in a slightly ironic way, the workplace, because it's not completely clear that that term, it feels like a term from about 50 years ago. And work is changing. And if social democracy was premised on an idea of collective bargaining and other kinds of abilities to resist domination within the settings of a particular corporate or working structure, work has become more dispersed. It's less organized than it was. You're worried about the role of algorithms. It's also being replaced in different ways, or at least human beings are working within institutional structures that are themselves dominated by mechanical processes, it becomes harder to see this is about this group of people trying to resist the domination of this group of people, because so much of it is mediated by impersonal, mechanical, digital structures that make it harder to see that relationship. Never mind 0 hours contracts and, you know, curated careers and agent-centered views of work, where you're just a human being trying to make a living in the world by doing multiple different things in different ways with different organizations, all of that.
No, I don't agree with that. I think I have a very different view in terms of how do you account for this change and the fact that I don't think it's just the changing nature of work. I mean, of course, technology changes and work changes, but every decision that of which we are in some ways a victim is policy decision. So you can regulate or you can deregulate. And I think the fact that work has been deregulated, fragmented and so on, there has been institutional accountability at every step of this process. And in part, this is what neoliberalism was initiating a series of changes that deregulated the state in such a way that at some point citizens or workers or however you want to call it, began to lose control. We have coordinated platforms for the holders of capital, right? So we have the people who have wealth are very coordinated. So how is it that it just so happens that we have a lot of coordination on that side and no coordination on this side? Well, these are all the results of policy decisions. And this is, again, going back to Machiavelli, how you think about institutions will condition what kind of life you lead. And we have ended up with these deregulated lives for some, where the power is all on the other side. And so to go back again to Machiavelli, the few and the many, the few are extremely coordinated, have all the bargaining power, can influence policy decisions and influence them to their advantage. And on the other hand, you are left with this argument, well, it's the changing nature of work and these things have happened and the technology has changed and the workers can't coordinate. And it's not inconceivable that you could coordinate workers across digital platforms, for example, or that you could have ways of organizing strikes, or that you can, just like we coordinate a lot of other things and we adapt to technological change. It's just in whose interest these changes are being made. And I think that's where the difficulty is right now. It's that we have lost the capacity to be represented by parties or by actors in society that are willing to make this Machiavellian argument on behalf of the many, as Machiavelli would say.
You said these were accountable decisions, but what you mean is these were decisions that were in theory accountable, but these people were not held to account.
So the policymakers decided to cater to some interests and not to other interests. So they were accountable to the rich, but not accountable to the poor, as it were. And that's, in a way, I think, the story of the deregulations of the last few decades.
So I want to ask you, what would then make this accountable in the sense that you're calling for? And to go back to Machiavelli, so there's an understanding here that in a free city, there has to be accountability. And accountability includes giving an account. I mean, literally, justifying what you're doing to the people over whom these decisions are going to be made. And they have to be able to reject the account that you give. So a lot of this does depend on it happening in particular places, physical places or political institutional spaces. And it has to be quite stylized or ritualized. Someone presents the case and other people have the opportunity to question them and to push back. I'm not trying to say there's a kind of technological determinism at work here, but this is a more dispersed political environment. The institutions are more dispersed in some way. Some of the capital is concentrated and some of the power is concentrated, but the places in which it is possible to hold people to account compared to a late medieval city, Italian city-state, a relatively small number of people, you know where it happens, you know how it happens. It's much harder now.
Yeah, but that was also the argument for this transition to modern representative democracy. So the emergence of parties was, in a way, the response to precisely the complexity of modern politics and the idea that then have these agents in society that are with one foot in civil society and one foot in lawmaking and policymaking, and they are able to precisely coordinate across these different realms and to navigate this complexity on modern society. And I still think, I mean, it is a kind of old-fashioned argument, but I still think there's a lot to be said for the parties and maybe with ideas of how you can innovate or how you can coordinate transnationally. And it seems to me that actually, when you look at what happens in contemporary politics, some party configurations are able to coordinate. So if you look at the far right, they have an agenda across Europe, across the world, with much the same features, which has this sort of anti-immigrant, exclusionary, conspiratorial elements. And it seems to me that they have been able to coordinate transnationally and to adapt to the transformations of modern politics and to navigate this technological complexity and to drive their message forward and to press it. So it's not that it can't be done. It's not infeasible. It's more, I think, a question of lack of ideas and lack of political will and also despair in a way on the side of those who would have the responsibility to propose an alternative discourse.
Isn't it partly despair because people no longer believe in that notion of accountability? So if you have a politics that's driven by conspiracy theories, part of what lies behind that is the thought that it's not going to be possible to hold these people to account because there isn't now a space or a language in which you can believe them. And that is a function, a feature of 21st century political life, that actually it's not just we need to rediscover accountability in these institutions. Accountability in these institutions to many people no longer seems like a plausible means of asserting our right not to be dominated. What you have to do is be much more rejectionist than that. So a conspiracy theory isn't just exercising a veto, it's saying this is all bullshit and I want to come up with a completely different account of how the world works, where I'm not going to hold you to account because anything you say is not to be believed.
None of these are brute facts. I think the problem is that I agree with you that there isn't sufficient bravery in a way in coming up with a challenge to the status quo that isn't just a right-wing challenge. That's sort of, you have a challenge to the status quo that says, okay, and now let's go back to the past. Let's go back to this idea of homogeneous societies where, you know, there were no foreigners, no immigrants, never mind that was never the case because every society is made of comings and goings and so on. But somehow that message, they are able to drive it. And the problem is that on the alternative side, there is not enough courage in articulating what would a rejection of the status quo be that doesn't end up in embracing and in longing nostalgically for the past, but has a vision of the future. And I think for that, you need a combination of the Socratic skills and discourse and kind of radical critique with the then Machiavellian element of institutional design and policymaking and parties and institutions that are able to then channel these ideas and turn them into day-to-day politics. But I don't think it's impossible and I don't think there's anything necessary. It's just that I don't know. I don't want to call it just psychological, but it seems to me there is a general despair and beating oneself up and saying, oh, there is no alternative, there is no alternative. And of course, there is a point where that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because, yeah, there will be no alternative if you carry on thinking that there is no alternative.
Part of what I think here is that it's weirdly a kind of institutional courage. You're not going to found the state, but you can refound some of the institutions. And the challenge here is you want accountability. Accountability depends upon robust institutions. But robust institutions to offer accountability have to be ones in which people have some confidence. So there's always a tension there. It goes back to the very first question I asked you in this conversation, which is how you combine civic virtues with the suspicion, which is part of resisting corruption and domination. And there is a version of suspicion that is corrosive, just as there's a version of civic virtue, if it's a sort of passive, we're just good, loyal citizens, which is also corrosive. You have to have the two. And it does feel to me, and I've felt this for a while, that we're weirdly attached to our institutions. We really think, you know, we mustn't, you know, democracy will collapse if we tear these institutions down and try and build some new ones because it's too dangerous in the world that we live in. If we don't defend our institutions, if we're not good citizens and say we believe in democracy, we believe in parliamentary government, we believe in elections, we won't question this and that, the whole thing will fall apart. And at the same time, we're clinging on to these institutions past the point where anyone believes in them anymore. And so then what you get is the version of politics we have now, which is the people who get elected are the ones who have no faith in the institutions. Therefore, what do you have to do? You need new institutions.
I think we disagree on this. I don't think the problem with these institutions, the problem is with the institutions that are dominated and controlled by market forces that are impersonal and for which there is oddly no institutional tracking because this is the world we live in and because that is no one is really willing to challenge the fact that there is a socioeconomic structure that underpins our politics. And we think about everything other than changing the structure because that seems too radical. And what would it mean to think about alternative property regimes or what would it mean to think about distribution of social roles in this fundamental way?
So I don't think we do think about everything. I think it's weird the extent to which in the politics of the liberal democratic West, we don't think about radical institutional reform. Actually, we're incredibly concerned. Even radical politicians, relatively radical politicians, are incredibly conservative about that. And if you want to change the world, you have to start somewhere. And it is really striking to me the extent to which there is a risk aversion around radical institutional reform of some of the things that you were talking about there. So you say maybe we need a tribunate for the poor. One of the challenges to that is to persuade people that that would mean changing the way that parliamentary government works. And people throw their hands up in horror. They think that is the step on the road to the end of democracy, whereas actually democracy ends if we just carry on going through the motions.
Yeah, I mean, I gave you the argument in favor. I'm not so convinced myself that this is the way to go in terms of class differentiated institutions in the long run as well. I think of it more as a kind of transitional measure. So in the end, that comes down to how you think about politics and whether you think conflict is always present and has to be present. And I think maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic, maybe. And so I think these institutions are important transitionally in the intermediate, but I don't think they are the ultimate goal. I think the ultimate goal is to really have democracy that functions in the universal representative way in which democracy aspires to function. I'm kind of sitting on both sides there. But I think I agree with you that, yes, we have to be a lot more brave on institutional design. But there is a part of our lives, which is the capitalist market, that is outside these institutions. That is what needs to be recaptured for these institutions also to be able to do their work. Because if you don't at all touch that, then all of these institutions will find ways of being captured by wealthy and privileged interests and of being subject to unequal influence and lobbying and all the things that we're familiar with. There will be a way in which capital will creep in and find a way to control. So unless we're prepared to have that conversation, I'm not sure that this by itself, putting all our faith in institutional radical innovation, will fundamentally change things.
Finally, I just want to go back to where we started. So there's the free state. How is it free internally? And then to be a free state, you have to exist in a world of other states and other powers that will try to conquer you. And if Machiavelli's deeply pessimistic about freedom, it's partly because it's really hard to be a free state in that first sense, given you also have to defend yourself in the second sense. And you also have to, in Machiavelli's terms, really aspire to be a bit of a dominator yourself. The way to be a really secure state, the way to be Rome, is you conquer the world. And if you conquer the world, then it's very hard for anyone to conquer you. And there will be in any state, including any free state, an impulse to achieve security by means of preemptive domination of the people who threaten you, because that's the basic requirement for freedom. Not to be at risk. You'll really be cowed if you think someone's about to come and enslave you. And to Machiavelli's story of Rome is there's a founding, there's republicanism, but republicanism in the end morphs into something which is much more like a dominating power. The United States follows a similar trajectory. There are grounds for thinking Machiavelli would say that is, and then it falls apart again and then the cycle begins again. But that is the order of things.
Yeah, that is maybe one of the limits of Machiavelli's thought in a way, and it may be that the ideal of non-domination remains and you have to think about a world. And I tend to think that there is then other figures in the history of political thought that are better able to articulate this. And I think Kant is one of them, where you have a view of a world that is free from domination, where you have cooperation or mechanisms of cooperation between states such that the freedom is preserved of all these different communities without any one of them becoming dominating and imperially subjugating all the others. I think in Machiavelli's case, it was maybe harder historically to see how that would be the case because these were the models that he had in front of him and because society had changed, but not in the way in which we know it to have changed afterwards. And so there are some obvious limitations of what he was writing about and could come up with in a way that would lead from this internal ideal of freedom from domination within a city-state to thinking, okay, what if the world was a city-state? How would we then think about relation between different states and what would need to be in place for that? But in our world, I think we're actually more able to think about that because we are much more interdependent, because we have a degree of connection between these different states and degree of vulnerability, of common vulnerabilities. I mean, Machiavelli wouldn't really have known anything about climate change, for example, and what that does to your self-sufficiency and dominating and conquering. It's all of these things change their parameters once the types of problems that you're confronted with change. And so maybe that's where we just have to say bye to Machiavelli and go move on to something else.
If you'd like to subscribe to PPF Plus, where you will get ad-free listening, no adverts on past or future episodes, and you'll also get the bonus episodes that accompany this and all our series. Just click on the link that comes with the show description or go to ppfideas.com. You will also get our fortnightly newsletter, and we have been made aware that the last newsletter that went out last Friday did end up in some people's junk or spam folder. We're sorry about that, and we're trying to do what we can to make sure it doesn't happen again. But if you were expecting the newsletter and it didn't arrive, do check junk or spam for last Friday. You should find a copy there. You might find two, because we had another go at sending it out. Coming up next time on The History of Freedom, I'm talking to Leia about the German philosopher Immanuel Kant and his idea of enlightened freedom. Is it really plausible to think that we could achieve universal, perpetual peace? And what are the limits of free thought and free expression? This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com